A recent opinion piece in the New York Times caught our eye. The headline read, "Don't let your children grow up to be farmers." Because, the writer said, despite the popularity of the local food movement, the small-scale farmer has a very hard time making a living. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, August 26th. I suspect we might have some small-scale farmers listening right now. Is it that bad? Would you want your children to follow in your footsteps? Why or why not? Let us know your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Don Boustros, an organic family farmer who trains emerging farmers in New Mexico and helps develop farmer networks throughout the state. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for joining us very early in the morning in New Mexico. I should explain that we did contact the writer of the op-ed, Bren Smith, to appear on the show, but Bren thought you would... You are more eloquent in discussing these issues, so you can thank Bren later, okay?
Yeah.
But anyway, so how hard is it to be a small farmer?
Well, you know, to be a small farmer, it's a very difficult challenge. It's a very difficult challenge. It takes years of perfecting a skill that not a lot of people have. And then in a lot of instances, the infrastructure isn't there that allows you to participate in the marketplace or in the distribution in a way that's beneficial to the small farmer themselves.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I'm not sure I quite get that.
So I think what I mean by that is that there are a lot of places where small farmers have a difficult accessing the market areas.
In terms of selling produce and that sort of thing?
Yeah, instead of selling produce towards institutional buyers like the schools or in some instances the prisons or the different kinds of institutional purchasers that are open to more larger farms and larger distribution networks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit more challenging to be able to break into those kind of market opportunities being a small farmer. And that's why aggregating product together between small farmers and creating these networks is so important, because that allows the small farmer to be able to have enough volume to be able to compete on these kind of larger markets.
Mm-hmm. Well, why is it so hard to break into that marketplace? With, you know, CSAs are growing, at least in Wisconsin. There are, you know, farmers markets in practically every community. There are now, you know, local sections, organic sections in some conventional grocery stores even. Why is it that so many farmers, according to the piece, are still operating in the red? Why can't the farmers get involved in all these things?
So I think Bren had a couple of different ideas on when he wrote this article, and one was to bring the discussion up of how challenging it is to be able to be a successful small farmer. It's not impossible to do, and there are several thousands and maybe tens of thousands of people, young people and people that are doing it now. So there are people that are doing it, and there are ways to do it. But I think Bren wanted to bring up the discussion is that, are there other ways that the government and subsidies through the Farm Bill might be able to support a more local and regional food system that allows small growers to participate in the food security issues of how healthy food is distributed in the local communities, how it's grown, and where the local economy is developed. Instead of the money being exported to corporate models, the money stays in the local communities and is circulated right in the local community itself.
Mm-hmm.
So it is difficult, but it's not impossible to do. And I think Bren's idea was to start to bring the discussion up is, how are these government programs, or how may they benefit small growers or growers to participate in a more viable manner?
Now, the as I mentioned, the headline certainly caught our eye. Don't let your children grow up to be farmers. Now, Brendan, exactly. Say that in the piece,
yeah, exactly.
But I mean, just where do you stand on whether we should be encouraging our children to be farmers or not?
You know, I've done it my entire life. Our farm has been in our family for over 400 years, and I have a training program that we teach people every year how to become successful growers. It's a year-long training program, and then another 2 years of technical support after that. So my personal feeling is that there should be more growers participating in the food system for multiple reasons, as we talked about earlier: the economic benefit to the communities, the environmental benefit about being able to use sustainable food practices or food growing practices within the region is considering all the limitations that are provided by the natural resources, and then the social aspect of being able to communicate with your neighbors being your customers, feeding healthy food to the young children in the communities. So there's multiple reasons why I believe that small growers are an integral part of the food system and why they should be encouraged to continue growing food. But I think Bren brought up the discussion is that there are a lot of challenges that the federal farm programs could address that would help facilitate the increased numbers of these growers throughout the U.S.
So give us an example of one thing the federal farm policies could address that would make it better.
Well, you know, I think a lot about is about the research programs that are going on now. I know the Western SARE program and the SARE programs across the U.S. are very beneficial because they're doing research on sustainable agriculture within the four different regions or in different regions across the United States that address problems within their growing and bioregions where people live. So that's a good example of USDA, the federal farm programs, increasing the ability for researchers to do research on sustainable agriculture and to increase the participation of growers, whether they're producers of meats, grains, or vegetables, to participate in those research programs so that it's not isolated in its own little silo, but there's both researchers and growers participating in the design, implementation, and then the sharing of the results. There's also different programs within NRCS, the Natural Conservation Resource Service, and those programs help a lot on the conservation areas, being able to attract pollinators, soil conservation, irrigation through the EQIP programs. And then there's also the Beginning Farmer Rancher programs that help young farmers get started through training that allows training to go on in different areas, and several other programs that we could talk about that are quite significant and beneficial to the smaller growers across the U.S., and which are increasing, but they continue to need these supports that are in place and being able to modify the supports as the needs arise throughout the different regions.
We are talking with Don Boustros, an organic family farmer who trains emerging farmers in New Mexico and helps develop farmer networks throughout the state. We're talking about the challenges facing small farmers and some solutions for moving forward. And we wonder if you are a small farmer struggling to make ends meet, or have you found financial success? What do you think about the state of family farms and what can be done to make them better, to help sustain the family farm or the small farmer? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our conversation is prompted by a recent New York Times opinion piece that urged readers, don't let your children grow up to be farmers. What do you think of that advice? Would you encourage your child to be a farmer? Why or why not? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Between grocery stores, farmers markets, and restaurant fare, local organic foods seem to be more popular than ever. But we are finding out why small farmers are still having a difficult time. It's challenging for the farmers who produce that food to actually turn a profit. From a New York Times opinion piece recently, the dirty secret of the food movement is that the much-celebrated small-scale farmer isn't making a living. After the tools are put away, we head out to second and third jobs to keep our farms afloat. 91% of all farm households rely on multiple sources of income. Healthcare, paying for our kids' college, preparing for retirement, not happening. With the overwhelming majority of American farmers operating at a loss, the median farm income was negative $1,453 in 2014. Farmers can barely keep the chickens fed and the lights on. Wow, is it like that for you? Or did you know that? Let us know your questions and experiences at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is talking with us about the challenges facing small farmers and some solutions for the plight. Don Boustros is an organic family farmer who trains emerging farmers in New Mexico. And before we go to the phones, and we have lots of callers who want to go in. Don, what is it like for you? Is it that hard?
Well, you know, it's a job. It's a job. I don't want to pull any punches. It's a job, and with any kind of a small business owner, there's always challenges. I mean, that's part of what it is to be an entrepreneur, is that you take the cake and the pie with a lot of times the not so good successes. So, you know, we've been able to make a living. Our family and the people that we work with are able to make a living. It's a lifestyle choice, as Brent mentioned. It's a lifestyle choice, and as a few of the other people that wrote the responses to the articles. So it's not like you're going to have a brand new Mercedes Benz in the garage every year, but if you enjoy being your own boss, if you enjoy making decisions that impact your community, if you're able to live with your family, to have a family business, and those are some of the values and some of the core venues and values that small independent farmers have. You know, we're independent and we're small business people for a reason. So I don't want to make it sound it's a piece of cake. There's challenges, there's ups and downs, but if you stick to it, you use wise business decisions, risk management practices, you can't be successful. You're not going to become a Ted Turner, but there are ways to pay the bills, enjoy a family life, and be part of your community. And I think those are some of the choices that all of us are making and younger people are making, that a lot of times there's social and environmental and family trumps monetary gains. So I think we have to start to balance both of them, and I think that that's one of the bigger issues that Brandon and a few other people have been addressing.
Let's hear from some callers. Adam in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead.
I was just going to say all the education and everything is good, but if the new farmer can't afford to rent the ground or afford to buy the equipment, it does no good. The big guys are basically pricing everybody out of the ballpark. I mean, me, I couldn't afford to go out to buy a $100,000 tractor. I couldn't afford to go out and buy a $50,000 tractor. But the big guys, they can buy, they're big enough now where they can buy something new every year. And with newer, bigger equipment, they can afford to just write off and just buy everything up from the little guy.
So, Adam, you are a little guy?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So what about that? Are the big farms making it harder for the little farms, Don?
You know, I totally agree with what Adam said there. I think that's part of what we're talking about in this kind of subsidies, or maybe even kind of talking a little bit more more out there, is there has to be this kind of land access issue addressed in a real meaningful way that allows people to use land as long as it needs to be used to grow good, healthy food for communities and to feed people across our own regions and communities, but also across the U.S. so that we become a more independent food source for our own communities. And it's going to have to happen, I think, through government reform. So I totally agree with Adam that there has to be changes in policies that starts to level out the playing field, whether it's for land reform, access to financial resources, or I think the bigger picture is just looking about, and this is going to, I hope it doesn't get too many people upset, but it's going to be having to look about where large farm subsidies are going. And starting to develop regional food systems instead of global food systems, and it's not that we're going to not that I'm suggesting we abandon any one of them, but that we have to look to port more federal resources in the forms of these kinds of subsidies that Adam is kind of thinking about, to be able to level out that playing field that Bren and a lot of us are talking about on all the different levels that. It's a cost of food doesn't reflect the cost of producing it, and we could get into a lot of the other details, but I think Adam is right on mark. Adam, I think you're right on mark.
Thank you, Adam. Tom in Burlington is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I just came back from the school board meeting yesterday. I was the only one who got up and spoke out of 200 people. And what I talked about was we have a disconnect between our schools and our farmers. I live in a rural community here. And why the farmers can't get people to work on the farm, and why can't we make it part of the curriculum that the children work on a farm at some point during their high school years and make it safe for them so that they know where the food is coming from, and the farmer has this labor thing, the labor problem. Now, summer vacation was meant for kids to be out of school so they could help work on the farm. Now the kids don't work on the farm, and they sit at home twiddling their thumbs, and it's not a good thing. And right here, we are right near the Chicago Board of Trade. If our kids here learned about farming and chemicals and pesticides and herbicides and all that kind of stuff, they could go down to the Board of Trade and make lots and lots and lots of money.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'd like your idea.
All right. What do you think of that idea? Making farming, I guess, a part of the school curriculum, Dan.
So Tom, I'm really happy to hear that there's some of us that are really like-minded, Tom. And I don't know about having young people working on the farm because there's child labor laws, and as you mentioned, health and safety issues that occur. But I do know that, or I feel, let me put it this way, I feel that there should be more education integrated into the schools, into the institutional programs. And in New Mexico, we developed a curriculum that addresses and meets all the benchmarks and standards for the New Mexico schools. But it's hard to get it distributed into the school systems themselves and then for the teachers to use it because of all the standardized kind of activity that's occurring. But I think that the more young people understand where their food is coming from, how it's grown, as Tom is saying, really starts to shift that mentality that food is cheap and starts to shift it more that there's a value to farmers, and it starts to bring self-esteem up to farmers and to growers or to ranchers, any kind of food producers in all along the food chain, not only the growers but the people that serve it, the people that prepare it. There's a whole system within the food system that it has to be elevated. The food, I think, has to be elevated to a different level of discussion and a different level of honoring everybody that grows it and how we all participate within the food system itself.
Thank you very much, Tom. We have just a little over a minute before we need to take a news break, and of course we'll continue after the news break. But Don, I understand the response to this, to Bren's op-ed piece has been stunning. People are he has started that conversation.
Yes, and you know, Brent really put it in a way that got people's attention, but opened it up for several different interpretations for the article itself. And he has gotten quite a bit of responses. I'm fortunate enough to have done another radio show, also interview, and I know he's doing a lot more in follow-up also. So, you know, it's important to have these kind of conversations across multiple regions and across the United States, so that, you know, people do think that there are a lot of us thinking on the same lines, that there has to be a change, and now all we have to do is, as Brent said, is mobilize on the national level, and let our decision makers and policy development people is understand what we need and how we want it to change too.
We will talk more about how smaller farmers might mobilize to meet the needs of the country and meet their own needs after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about how difficult it is for small-scale farmers to make a living and some possible solutions. Our conversation is prompted by a recent New York Times op-ed piece, Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Tuesday, August the 26th. And we are talking with Don Boustros, who is an organic family farmer who trains emerging farmers in New Mexico and helps develop farmer networks throughout the state. He was recommended to us by the writer of this op-ed piece, and Bren Smith, who wrote that it's time for farmers to shape our own agenda. We need to fight for loan forgiveness for college grads who pursue agriculture, programs to turn farmers from tenants into landowners, guaranteed affordable health care, from shifting subsidies from family farms or from factory farms to family farms. We need to take the lead in shaping a new food economy by building our own production hubs and distribution systems. And we need to support workers up and down the supply chain who are fighting for better wages so their families can afford to buy the food we grow. None of these demands will be met until we start our own organizations, as in generations past, and shape a vision of a new food economy that ensures that growing good food also means making a good living. So what do you think? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So because we have full lines, let's go back to the phones. Keith in Beaver Dam is with us. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Yeah, I grew up on a small family farm and have friends and family that are still farming and dairy farming, and they're working their tail off. And it's not a real sexy job. You're working 14, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. But the tax structure encourages people to go bigger, and the debt is such a detriment to people to get that size. I mean, you know, once these large farms get established in the area, it is almost impossible to rent land or buy land to start a small farm. And these small farms, they had, you know, they used to have large families. They'd fill the schools and the churches and you know, that was their labor force, and now these big farms, they don't have the big families, so and now they got the labor shortage, and for example, like last year when we had all the wet weather, these large farms, well, they get whether they produce land on crops on their land, they get paid. I seen the small family farmer, he's got to get a crop off that land, where these big farms, a lot of them are sitting idle. They let them go. So I'm just saying that the small family farmer, I mean, we got to get back to that. That's the backbone of the country, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Don, a comment? Oops, I'm sorry. I have to turn your microphone on, so to speak. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, Keith, I agree with what you said there. You're right on there that there has to be a way that we start to go back, not backwards, but go forward to more local production. And there's ways to do it. And I think that's what we're talking about is creating these models across the United States that allows people to look at them, examine them, and then create models for local production, local economies, and local labor forces that people want to stay in their local communities and they want to be part of it instead of having this kind of brain drain that occurs. So I think that's what we want to talk about, Keith, is what kind of changes do we need to make on the federal level, state and local level, that allows these kind of food systems to be more productive.
Yeah. Talk about this new food economy that was being advocated in the piece by building our own production hubs and distribution systems.
Mm-hmm. So that to me, and I think Brent really talked about, I really liked that one piece of his article talking about what he feels, and I think a lot of us would support what he's saying is, some of the specific changes that should be made that would allow for this new food economy to start to occurring. And part of it is these kind of regional food systems that he talks about, is to have enough growers. And what we do is we train the growers as the food systems are being developed, because a lot of the criticism says is if we go back to a local food system, not enough people are growing the food to meet the demand. So that's the large corporate argument. Oh, there's not enough people growing food. They're too small, they're not efficient enough, and they can't meet the demand for the local need. But by creating models that allow us to show that it is possible to do it, and I want to say possible in a way where, as Keith said, is that we're not slaves to the land. And there's modern technology in different areas that allows us to incorporate with traditional culture to be smart business people where we can work, you know, 8, maybe 10 hours, 5, 6 days a week, like everybody else across the United States. There's all of us are struggling, but be able to put enough money and bread on the table to have a happy family and a healthy family. So those kinds of things that we're talking about is creating these local food hubs, having the farmers trained, learning growers how to participate together, having the food brought to a central location in their own regions, wherever that might be, and then distribute it to their local schools, to their local institutions, the senior citizens, the schools, the different restaurants. And that's the new food economy, instead of having it grown, shipped out somewhere else, produced, and then brought back. In New Mexico, and I'm not sure how it is out in Wisconsin, but in New Mexico, 98% of all the food grown, only 2% stays in the local economy. The other 98% leaves the state and then comes back into the state. So we want to talk about, if we're growing food in the different regions, how do we make it stay in that region and really start to increase that local economy and value that local food instead of it being shipped out of the state or out of the area and then brought back in?
Yeah, that doesn't seem to make much sense at all. but that it's shipped out and then comes back in. I don't know precisely how it works in Wisconsin, but I do know that in many of the urban areas, at least, and that I'm familiar with, and here in Madison, we do have a big growing CSA movement. We have farmers markets all over the place. We have my local grocery store has a big local section and highlights local foods. And I mean, is this unique that this is happening in, say, Madison, Wisconsin?
No, I think we see that trend occurring all across the U.S. And by the way, I've been to Madison and to your market, and it is one of the most beautiful markets I've seen across the United States.
Yeah, it's special.
Fortunate to, Yeah, it is. It is. You folks there have a very beautiful and special market.
Yes.
But it is a trend that's occurring. But I think Brand's point, too, is that it's not enough. And I think it's still limited to just a few percent. I don't know what the percentage is. But at best, I don't think it's in the 10% level yet of local food. So we have a big ways to go, and there's a lot of opportunities for us to be able to grow this local new food economy. So if we're like at 2% in New Mexico, and if you folks are a little higher in Wisconsin, we still have another 90% that we can shift to local economy. And that's what we're talking about, is going from farmers markets, going from CSAs, and let's go to the larger markets that allow more food distribution and more growers to participate.
Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, greetings. It's Thomas Jefferson in his second inaugural talked about this problem, so it's pretty clear that it's still never gotten resolved. He said back then that we need the economy based upon agriculture with commerce as its handmaiden. And so, you know, obviously the inflation rate has gone up faster than the price of food. And so you can't get hired help to reap the crops and whatnot. But I was going to ask him, there have been a number of corporate mergers lately. ConAgra has bought up Cargill. Dan Quayle has bought up Safeway with a zero interest loan. This whole problem that Thomas Jefferson was talking about is really exacerbated when there's fake money that's allowing the food system to be monopolized.
Yeah. All right. Do you know much about that, Don?
You know, you're right. You know, I think that and Adam, the first caller, and talked about it a little bit, is how come these large corporations get all these subsidies, whether it's tax-free land, and then after that they apply to farm bill programs that allows them to raise crops at a loss and still get paid for it, so that the global economy stays floating. There's these huge questions about, you know, how much power these corporations and individuals have and how they're impacting small growers like ourselves right here in a small village in Santa Cruz, New Mexico. And it has huge impacts because they're able to acquire this, as you said, free funding. A lot of times they're able to get exemptions to existing environmental laws, and then they're able to produce this cheap food and then distribute it in any manner that they so wish. And then that's where we get our food diseases coming from, our foodborne illnesses, is that it's such a large system that there's no checks and balances that are really effective that allow us to have a safe food system. But that's a huge and a lot different discussion that we could go into.
Well, we will continue talking with Don Bustos, an organic family farmer who trains new farmers in New Mexico and helps develop farmer networks throughout New Mexico, talking about how it's not easy to be a small farmer. We're talking about the challenges facing the small-scale farmer, the family farm, and some solutions for moving forward. And we're welcoming your questions. We're welcoming your experiences. Are you a smaller farmer struggling to make ends meet? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. What reforms do you think are needed to help sustain the small-scale farmer? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with a guest about a recent New York Times piece, Don't Let Your Children Grow Up to Be Farmers, and we're welcoming your thoughts and questions for him on how to help the small-scale farmer. And we have a number of emails, including Charles in McHenry, who emails, what effect on food prices would paying farm workers, that's a little, what effect on food prices All right. I'm sorry about that. The email is asking whether we should be paying farm workers livable wages, and goes on to say you will never get anyone interested in farming unless wages are there. And then I'm thinking he's wondering, you know, is that going to have a big effect on food prices if we pay farm workers a living wage? Don?
Oh yeah, there's no doubt in any, I think, and I hope in anybody's mind that everybody should be paid a living wage, and that they should have health insurance, and then any kind of support that's needed, you know, through all of our kind of existence. So a living wage is part of what I advocate for and try to support. The model that I feel that we need to do is not become workers, but start to use small businesses and entrepreneurs as the model. So I know there's a lot of growers, and I hate to drop names, but I think Elliot Coleman up in the Northeast is an example, and I could speak to other growers that are examples. But there are models where a person or two people can make a decent living off of 3 to 5 acres. And we promote here in northern New Mexico, and New Mexico, the programs, is between 3 to 5 acres of land can be managed by one and a half people, and not on a slave basis, but on a regular work basis, and still make enough income to support the family. But I say that with a caveat that we've been developing these models and practicing them for over 20 years. So if you want to start up in day one and say in a year or 2 years, I'll have the markets developed and I'll have all the techniques in place, that's not going to happen. And I think that's what we need to talk about, is those infrastructure needs that will allow new growers to jump into the market in a fair and equitable manner, and they don't have to fight their way in, whether it's against other smaller growers that have already been participating for a number of years, or a large agricultural industry that has, as other people have talked about, cornered the market just because of the subsidies and the breaks that they get. The other way you can look at it, too, is the farm workers is through this kind of improvement through mechanicalization for small growers. It's not like it used to be with Grandpa, where people would get behind the mule, pull the plow, and then weed all day. There's a lot of advances with precision tools, precision hand tools, precision harvesting tools that allow us to be able to produce enough food without breaking our backs. So there's a combination about addressing worker rights, but also addressing what the new models look like so that we're all independent people and not just a drone where you show up at 8 o'clock in the morning, go to work, and then leave. I think that's what I would like to see, is more independence, more self-reliance, more small businesses being incubated all along the food system, whether it's growing, washing, harvesting, operating. But those are all small businesses that can be developed, and they'll start to increase our local economy and our local food system that allows a better price for our food.
Yeah, and it's a great answer. But if we're paying people more to produce the food, then we're paying more for the food itself. Is that? But that's the way it's got to be.
That's the way it's got to be. I mean, there's a value to good, healthy food. You know, we can eat plastic processed food all day, or do you want to get good, healthy food where your kids and grandkids grow up to be clear thinkers? Spiritual people and people that value what's grown.
Victor in West Allis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, George, Victor here. Hey, on your guest there, is he making people aware that to become an organic farmer, you got to maybe, that's been previously chemicals used from another farmer, to detox that land that could take 3 to 5 years to take it out of with the commission and then get certified by the government that you're pure organic without any previous chemicals being used on the land itself?
Well, I'm not sure. So how does that relate, Victor?
Okay. To get certified, and even in your own beautiful programs you've had.
Well, maybe he's saying that it's too burdensome, the regulations, to be considered an organic farmer, Don.
It is a cumbersome process. I've been doing it since the 1980s. I was certified organic before USDA ever certified the word, and I was listening to all the discussions and participated in some of that policy that helped develop the federal farm rules for certified organic. But I don't think that, you know, and I don't want to disrespect anything, but that's not the only certification there is. And I feel that there is other natural grown local verification processes, or as in our local area, everybody knows everybody. So, you know, we know our practices and there's that local verification. But to be certified, you do have to fallow your land or produce a cover crop on it for a minimum of 3 years if you were using any kind of chemicals on the land itself and other regulations. But that's all part of your farm planning and your transition plan. So that's why I said earlier, there's no farmers that I know that are successful completely the first year without a lot of financial resources. So it takes multiple years. I think a good solid farm plan, as I say, takes anywhere from 3, 5 to 7 years to design and implement. So it's not a fly-by-night kind of an operation. And That's why I think farm planning, business planning, and development are so important to the success of these small businesses to be developed.
Joel in Manitowoc, we're almost out of time, Joel, but what did you want to say?
Hi, I'm a small organic farmer here in Manitowoc County. I got a herd of 20 cows. I have a good organic cooperative working for me, so the market of milk isn't a problem. The biggest problem I have is the government. Ever since the 1970s, when Earl Butts, the Secretary of Agriculture, they've initiated destructive family farm policies. I've got neighbors that are grain farmers, and when corn was $8, in the highest price in history, they were getting $1.2 million a year from the government, $550,000 a year from the government. Number one guy in Manitowoc County takes out the stuff for $2 million a year in farm subsidies. The Farm Service Agency loan officer, he takes up $400,000 a year.
Yeah, Joel, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. Don, you are calling for a reexamination of those subsidies, aren't you?
Yes, I am. I'm calling for an examination and a shift, not only an examination, but it's time to shift the way these farm subsidies are distributed.
Yeah. So how optimistic are you that we are going to see some of these changes that's going to help the small scale farmer?
Well, I see changes occurring on a yearly basis and on a regular monthly basis. But I think large food systems, it's taken us, I think, since the 1930s and 40s to get where we're at. So it'll take us hopefully half that time to shift it to where a lot of us believe that a local, healthy food system is a better food system than being dependent on an international food system. Not for everything, but for what can be produced and what people would like to eat in their local communities. So it's not like let's shift everything. But,
gotcha.
But I feel that there
gotcha.
Will be.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Don Bustos is an organic family farmer in New Mexico. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.